Is that a good book? Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday, June 12th meeting of the Senate Rules Committee. We are glad to see you all. We have a busy agenda, and being the Rules Committee, things have been happening fast today, so we will try to be as transparent as we go through these bills as we possibly can, and we're going to take them for the moment in order unless something happens to require us to jump around. So I will start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 789. And we heard this bill, actually have discussed it a few times. And Lori, do you just want to give us an update on where we are?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 789 was before you again yesterday, first time on the 5th of June, and then yesterday as well. And this is referencing the actuarial analysis of districts connected to the health plans with Oregon Educators Benefit Board. I can reread the whole summary if you'd like, or just go to the dash twos and just say there's all the paperwork that you need for the dash two amendments.
Great. Yeah, I think we did have that discussion at the last hearing, and we are in a work session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 5/23/13.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 789. And is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion to adopt the dash twos? Amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
I'd like to move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 789.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 789. To your motion.
You know, we had this conversation yesterday. Again, I just make the point that the districts that are outside of OEBB are saving a boatload of money, and I just like to provide every school district that same opportunity as we are fighting for every dollar to get into the classroom, lowering class sizes, keeping teachers hired, keeping full school years. This is a way to provide school boards the opportunity to decide for themselves whether they want to go to the private market, whether they want to stay in OEBB. Eventually, they'll have the choice to go into the exchange, but I trust school boards to make that decision, and I believe this amendment would afford them that opportunity.
Further discussion, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I am generally supportive of the intent of the dash four amendments, but having to discuss them, I understand that there is a constitutional problem if those are included in the bill, and I would hate to see the base bill lost. So regardless of my sense about it, I will not be supporting the motion.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Further discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Ferrioli.
Notwithstanding the constitutional problem, which I think we can all acknowledge, the audits were, the testimony was really clear. The audits were, I think, a tool to track. And the tracking demonstrated that those institutions that were able to use market forces cut costs. It's that clear. Those that were captive had their cost curve go up. That was clear. So the question really isn't whether or not there's a constitutional issue here. The question really is, did the underlying principle of the original policy perform as advertised? And it didn't. And so the issue here is, do you look at the market feedback, which is districts within the Portland, the same community that were out, which saved money, compared to districts that had to go in, were forced to stay in, lost money. Do you therefore take that science, which is proof from the marketplace that choice wins, and base the public policy on that, or do you ignore it and just continue to force people to spend more money and get less value? That's what this is really about. So I'll be supporting the dash four amendments.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Ferrioli, and I would just say that I think that this bill has been worked quite carefully through a policy committee before it got to the Rules Committee, and while I appreciate the desire to try to address every district in the state of Oregon, I don't think it would be particularly helpful to take a model that has been working successfully for many districts, and we heard testimony from some of them at our previous hearing on the bill, and having presented a solution that's been crafted and has consensus, I don't think that we need to unravel that by throwing the entire situation into chaos. And so I will be voting no as well. So any further discussion on the amendment? Mike, could you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Starr?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
No. And the motion fails. Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 789 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, procedural question.
Procedural question. Perhaps we need our committee administrator.
Well, Madam Chair, we did adopt the dash two, so
we already did adopt the dash twos.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, for clarifying that. So, Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 789, as amended by the dash two amendments, to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Senator Starr.
I support the underlying bill. I think it's a good bill. I'm going to oppose the motion to send it to the floor, and I will serve notice because I believe that the full Senate ought to have the opportunity to discuss what we've heard in this committee and the data that we've had in this committee. I believe that data, that information needs to be presented to the entire Senate through a minority report. But I, on the record, want to make a note that I support the base bill, and my expectation is that the minority report would include the base bill as well.
Further discussion? Okay. Mike, could you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries.
Madam Chair, I serve notice of possible minority report.
And Senator Starr has served notice of a possible minority report, and the bill moves to the floor with a do pass recommendation. I think we'll ask Senator Hass to carry this bill on the floor if he's willing to do so. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 789. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2199. And Lori, could you just give us an update on where we are on this bill?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2199A modifies the requirements of county election security plans to include number and location of video cameras located where ballots may be tallied. There are a number of provisions. This was before you for public hearing on May 22nd, and the provisions, I can read through all those. They focus on ballot security.
If you'd like me to, or members, I think, probably have the staff measure summary in front of them, but we'll give people a minute to catch up with where we are.
Madam Chair, there we have a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on the A engrossed version of 2199.
So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
I appreciate there's a lot in this bill that I think is positive. As it relates to security in our county elections offices, and I appreciate the work that the Secretary of State's office has put into this process. However, there continues to be significant concern about ballots and what we do with ballots, unused ballots, ballots that come back undeliverable, the extra ballots that are available, because when you print a certain number of ballots, you always have that overrun. Those concerns remain, and I wish that we could find a common ground or a solution to alleviate some of those concerns. And again, I'm not sure that you want to move this bill today or what your intentions are, but those concerns are real. I've heard through phone calls and emails today to my office, and actually over the last since we heard this bill before. And again, there's a lot in this bill that's positive, but as it relates to how we handle those ballots, there still remain some really serious concerns.
Senator Starr, I appreciate that. We did take extensive testimony when we held a public hearing on this bill from everybody that wanted to come forward, and I think there is a problem that this bill needs to address. We clearly have a need to adopt a solution to an inconsistency in the statutes, and while I'm aware that nobody will ever think that we've hit the perfect magic solution, I'm not sure, unless there are questions for the Elections Division, what we'd accomplish by delaying action on it today.
So your intention is to move the bill today?
That is my intention.
And we're in a work session?
And we are in a work session. So, Senator Beyer, do you have a motion?
Sure. If you're ready, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2199A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2199A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And Senator Starr, I would be perfectly happy to accommodate if you wanted to address a question to the Elections Division.
At this point, it would make no difference since the intention is to move the bill. So we'll just proceed, I guess.
Okay, so we have a motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Yes, Senator Beyer.
I appreciate the concerns that have been raised, and I frankly think that there may be some technical issues, but I think mostly what we're dealing with, and legitimate expressions of concern, it's more one of perception than I think perhaps reality, but the perception's there, and I don't think you're going to change that regardless of what we do to the bill. So I think the good pieces of the bill are there, and we ought to act on them and move it ahead.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, we had been given an opportunity by folks who do have concerns to consider the A2 amendment. And I wonder if the committee has seen the A2 amendment.
It's posted
on all of us.
Okay, so for people who might be listening at home, apparently we do have an A2 amendment that is posted electronically, right, on OLIS, and it is not an amendment that we have heard previously, but Lori, looks like you have it.
To hard copy. Uh-huh. It's to public on OLIS, Madam Chair, so anybody can access it.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Farioli, were you moving this amendment?
Madam Chairman, I would like to move the Dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2199.
Okay, we're on a motion to send the bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, so I'm trying to think how we would do this.
Madam, a motion to amend should be in order.
I think a motion to amend is in
mm-hmm.
order.
So while we're checking procedurally, if you, Lori, did you have an explanation of this or
no?
Okay, because we hadn't seen it previously. So, Senator Farioli, would you like to tell us what this amendment is
purporting
to do?
Madam Chair, the ballot or the amendment, the A2 amendment, inserts the word security after creating new provisions on page 1 in line 2 and on page 4. After line 9, it simply inserts section 4 that says, if a ballot that is mailed by a county clerk to an elector under ORS 254.470 is returned by the United States Postal Service as undeliverable, the county clerk shall, one, maintain a record of all the undeliverable ballots to the extent necessary for the county clerk to maintain accurate elector registration records, update elector registration records under ORS 247.292 and 247.296, and ensure that all eligible electors who make a request receive a replacement ballots under ORS 254.480, and, two, destroy the undeliverable ballot within 12 hours of its receipt. Madam Chair, this again tries to account for and eliminate unused ballots in the elections process.
And thank you, Senator Farioli. Without having had a chance to totally think about this, it appears that this amendment calls for, if I'm understanding this, that ballots that would be returned by the post office because the address was not current then have to be destroyed within 12 hours after they go back to the county. But meanwhile, the county is obligated to maintain accurate records of these undeliverable ballots while having destroyed them 12 hours later? Is that?
Madam Chair, maintain a record of the undeliverable ballots to the extent necessary for the clerk to update elector records. Okay. So, Madam Chair, it simply is if you get a ballot back that's undeliverable, you should note that it was sent to an address and it was returned. And because it's an unvoted ballot, it should be destroyed.
I see we have the Secretary of the Senate in the room as well. So,
a motion to amend is in order.
Uh huh.
And he's here if you have questions.
Okay. So, we're on a motion to amend with these dash A2s. And, Senator Beyer, did you have a comment?
When you're done with the procedures, I would like the Secretary of State's office to speak to that amendment.
Yes, I do see that we have Steve Trout and Gina Zedlick in the room, and so I don't know if you have testimony on this amendment, but if you do, we would certainly be...
I just got it as well.
It looks like you were just in receipt of it as well, so... Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Senate Rules Committee.
Steve, I'm kind of surprised that you, if you don't already, if the county clerks don't already do this with the exception of destroying the ballot.
So, good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director, and Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, the county clerks already do process that information that comes back from the post office to record all undeliverable ballots, and they will inactivate the voter based on that information. And then if it's appropriate, if it's been requested at the new address, then they can send a ballot to the new one. But all of that record keeping already takes place.
Madam Chair, the question really is not about record keeping. It's about what happens to unvoted ballots.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, those undeliverable ballots that are returned, it depends on the county and the activities that they have going on. They are secured, and depending on the workflow and the staffing levels within the county, depends on when they will process those, whether it's as they come in and come back from the post office, whether it's after all the ballots have come in, whether it's after the election. It's when they have time, given the priorities of all the competing things that they have to take care of during those few days before the election that we're talking about. And so some counties just, you know, have to make a priority decision to mail ballots out to people in the week before the election rather than go and document all of those undelivered ballots. But they are all secured and accounted for and maintained and under security, and then they are dealt with later or in real time depending on the county.
And I think so just to further clarify, under the language of the bill, which does reconcile the current inconsistency in the statute, there needs to be an accurate and accountable record of all the ballots in these various status, and I would assume that that includes the ones that have been returned as undeliverable, and that sounds like the current procedure that you're describing. So the thing that would change under the language of this amendment that I know you haven't seen but are looking at right now is a specific time period for shredding or otherwise destroying those ballots, which seems like it would then present a version of the same problem that the bill has been written to address.
Madam Chair, that's correct. As I've testified before, once a ballot's destroyed, I can't provide an accounting for it or show whether it was a blank ballot or whether it was a voted ballot or whatever. And so in order to be able to have a full accounting of all ballots, if someone wants to contest the election or do a recount, I need to be able to have all of those ballots to be able to have a a true accounting of all ballots that were available during that election. If I destroy some, there's no way for me to prove whether they were ballots from this election, from the last election. They may have been voted ballots. I just can't prove that negative. And so the best way to provide an accounting for all ballots is to be able to have access to all of them. And so, yes, destroying ballots before certification would pose the same problem that this bill is trying to alleviate.
Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Steve, I was thinking on that. I was thinking you want to keep it, but I assume if they're undeliverable in return from the post office, they are still a sealed ballot, and that you would want to keep that sealed envelope and not open it until after the election was certified.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that is the current practice.
And is that in OAR or is that in statute?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, it is not in statute. I believe it's in our vote-by-mail manual, but that is the current process.
But it is an established practice.
It is.
So you're not opening the envelope, so there isn't really the threat of having a ballot contaminated, if you will.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Byer, the only time that a ballot would be removed, an undeliverable ballot would be removed from its mailing package, would be if it was needed for a duplicate ballot after the election. But there are usually plenty of extra unvoted ballots to be able to use for those duplication processes. It's not necessary to open up those undeliverable ballots, but that would be the only occasion that they would.
So actually adopting this would probably, at least in perception, create a perception of lack of less security than holding the sealed envelope. In case the person voted in another place, you'd still have by holding the envelope, you'd have proof that ballot wasn't voted.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that's my opinion as well.
Yep.
So we have further questions for the Elections Division.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
Yeah, I think the underlying issue is the one that we're aiming at. We're talking about unused ballots. The law requires unused ballots to be destroyed at 8 p.m. on Election Day. The conflict is that the Secretary of State and the elections officials may need a tiny fraction of the unused ballots in order to replace ballots that might be damaged in counting or transportation or the mechanical process of opening. Nobody's characterized the number of damaged ballots in an election, but what we're doing to solve that problem is allowing thousands and thousands of unvoted ballots to lie around in elections offices. So the solution to the problem is to create a greater security risk by maintaining a population of unvoted ballots when the need for unvoted ballots is a tiny fraction of the total. So it seems to me that the logical solution could be that the Secretary of State or the elections officials in the counties retain a tiny fraction of the unvoted ballots. What the law that we have before us would do allow the elections officials to retain tens of thousands of unvoted ballots, you know, albeit in a secure condition. So, Madam Chair, I guess what I am arguing is that not that there's a perceived problem or an actual problem, but that the solution creates a greater security risk of integrity to our elections process, and that other solutions are available that would increase the security. So that it matter, Madam Chair, I can see convincing the elections officials or the members of the committee might be an impossibility. But I still believe that to solve this problem, you don't eliminate the necessity of destroying the unvoted ballots. You retain a small enough population to be what most folks would say was a reasonable number of unvoted ballots, given the past performance for damaging ballots or receiving damaged ballots. That has been a discussion that has just completely evaded our consideration. So it seems to me that the intent is to create a large pool of legal unvoted ballots at elections offices. And I don't think that means better security, Madam Chair. I think that means less security. So it may be a philosophical problem that we're having in addition to a constitutional problem.
And Senator Farioli, I appreciate those comments, and they seem like they're comments on the main bill, not necessarily that this amendment would address
that. Well, Madam Chair, then I call for the question on the amendment.
Can I have a comment?
I think Senator Stark does wish to speak.
I withdraw my call for the question, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Stark?
It seems to me that there's an easy answer to this problem, rather than holding these unused ballots, even if they left in the envelope, and that is to make a photocopy of every returned ballot. All you have to do is run it through the photocopy machine, and you got a copy of the returned ballot. You have the record that voter doesn't vote anymore. It takes care of the sub one of section four in the amendment. And it also identifies that, you know, you have a returned ballot, so you can count that against your, you know, ballot title, and you can destroy the ballot all in one, and you take this issue off the table. I would submit that every county clerk in the state, there's 36 of them, own a copy machine. It'd be really easy those every day when the post office comes back with returned ballots to quickly put them on the copy machine and run a copy just like that. And this issue is solved, and we don't have thousands potentially of unvoted ballots, even if they're left in their envelopes. You can then use that document as necessary to go back and take care of the voter file. You have the record that person didn't vote. You know what happened to that ballot because it got shredded, because that's what we do with ballots that are unvoted and returned. It's not a hard situation for me to figure out, and to a large extent takes care of at least portion of the issue that I think continues to underlie this entire conversation, and that's these ballots and what happens to them when they come back and are sitting around in a secure location, you know, in county elections offices. I don't think it's that difficult.
Is there a question or
respond? I mean,
I appreciate that that question. And with all due respect, it's not that easy. The counties have a lot of things going as those ballots are coming back in. And so even the time to go and photocopy each of them as they're coming in is keeping them from other things. You know, we're already getting criticized for not getting ballots out fast enough and to get the results out fast enough. The county election folks have a lot of things to do, and this would be another thing to add on that would take time away from other, what I would argue would be higher priority issues. The other point with respect to if we were to take a photocopy and then destroy those ballots after we took them out of the envelope, how do I prove that I did destroy them? And I think that's really part of the philosophical issue with some of those that are concerned about this. And, you know, again, I want to have as transparent a process as possible and to be able to go forward and say, here, anybody that has any doubts that these ballots were not tallied correctly or that there were ballots included in the count that shouldn't have, here's the entire scope of the number of ballots and envelopes and data and everything that you can want. Go and look at them. We've got nothing to hide, and account for it. And with all of the ballots there, you can do that accounting. If some have been destroyed, you can't. And so that's really the intent of the core bill.
May I respond?
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Zedlick.
My name is Gina Zedlick, Legislative Director for the Secretary of State. Madam Chair, Senator Starr, and members of the committee, I guess what I would say is that this bill, the underlying bill, goes to resolve a conflict in two statutes that currently exists, and maybe the bigger system needs to be revised. I think the county clerks would definitely have to be a part of. That's a bigger conversation than I think something that we can solve sitting here, and I think what the bill does is take some security steps in the meantime before maybe some of those discussions can happen. But I think would we have a judge hold that the two statutes that are currently in law are irreconcilable? So I think just getting that change made would be really helpful and go ahead with some of these discussions in the future with the county clerks with all their different processes weighing in on some of these ideas.
Thank you for your comment, and I don't see any further questions for you, so thank you for clarifying. And we are on a motion that Senator Farioli has made to adopt the A2 amendment. So the chair objects to that motion, and Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair, what are we voting on?
So we're voting on the amendment that Senator Farioli just presented.
You're a no.
That,
right. No. No.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Starr?
Yes.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
No. And the motion fails. And so we are back on Senator Beyer's original motion, which is to send House Bill 2199A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on his motion?
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
So what we're voting to do is allow the elections officials to keep potentially tens of thousands of unvoted ballots in their possession, and to eliminate the portion of the law that requires the Secretary of State and other elections officials to destroy unvoted ballots, since it's become evident that they are not currently following that law. Is that correct?
Are you addressing that question to me?
You, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, I'll render my opinion on that. I think what we are doing in House Bill 2199 is providing a workable and statutorily consistent solution so that we both are following the law. We are providing for, as we've heard in voluminous testimony, an accounting and a securing of all the ballots that have been voted, that have been returned as undeliverable, and doing that in an open and transparent way. And I think that is what this bill intends to do. We've obviously had a lot of testimony on all sides of this issue, and so that's my opinion about the solution that the bill presents. And I think that the last witness did make a good point that this will not be the last discussion, obviously, but I think that's what the bill does. Beyond that, I would just say that we've heard a lot of suggestions over the last couple of hearings that include things like that we should just print more ballots on the day of the election and not keep any unmarked ballots. So when people come in to vote, we would just print some more. And I think, you know, almost every scenario that you can think of, such as reproducing ballots and shredding ballots, raises these kinds of concerns about the security of our election system. So to me, for today, this bill presents a workable remedy, and one that I think we can present as a necessary one. So that is my opinion. Further discussion on the motion? Okay, Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries. And Lori, before you leave, I think we have Representative Barnhart in the room too.
Okay.
Madam
Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr?
Serve notice of possible minority report on House Bill 2190.
Thank you. Senator Starr has served notice of a possible minority report, and...
Oh, it's that time of year.
And we have a volunteer to carry this bill on the floor. I'll, then the chair will carry it. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2199. And I just see that Representative Barnhart has joined us and I think is here to talk about House Bill 3294. And so we will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3294. Thank you, Senator Barnhart, Representative Barnhart. I know you're running back and forth between the respective Rules Committees, and so welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the State Representative from House District 11. House Bill 3294 adds a fairly simple provision to the statute exempting certain records from disclosure. And in this case, we're talking about electronic mail addresses in the possession or custody of an agency or subdivision of executive department, a local government, or a local service district. And the point of this bill is to deal with the possibility that for commercial reasons or some other reason, people may ask for the disclosure of electronic mail addresses for purposes other than that they were given to the departments or the agencies or the local governments for in the first place. I think this is an important piece of legislation because it encourages people to use our systems, our online systems, to transact business with the state and with the other agencies, local governments, and so forth that I referred to. And in order to do that, those really ought to be restricted. The use of those email addresses really ought to be restricted to the purposes that the person gave them to those government entities for. From my point of view, this is one more piece that helps to encourage people to use efficient processes to do their business, knowing that they're not soon going to be spammed by the local soap company who has gotten their email address by asking for a public record.
Okay, thank you, Representative Barnhart. Any questions? Yes, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've got an interesting anomaly crop up, and it's now traced to several different administrations in Washington, D.C., among administrative employees who maintain email addresses that are outside of the normal channel of communications. And, you know, that's distressing to people because the information that's in emails is sent on public business, on public equipment by public officials is, in fact, public records. So if we move to put the addresses of people in administrations in the state of Oregon beyond the reach of citizens who would file FOIA requests, does that not facilitate, Madam Chair, the potential for hiding communications or doing out-of-channel communications or conducting business, public business, beyond the reach of the Freedom of Information Act, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, for the question. This bill is not intended to reach the kind of conclusion that you're referring to. If a person working in the government uses a private email address to transact government business, this does not prevent the contents of that email from being a public record and subject to disclosure. Let me just simply follow up with that, if I may. I received a letter from Dexter Johnson, the Legislative Counsel, on May 29th, 2013, which might be in your OLIS records. I'm not sure. And in that letter that he wrote me, and as I asked him about a related question, he said that nothing in this bill would prohibit an entity from disclosing those addresses if it elected to disclose them. If you have a situation, as you posit, where someone is using a private email address to transact public business and would try to use this provision as an attempt to hide the contents of that email, the agency could still disclose that if it chose to do so. The point of this is not to hide information of the kind you're talking about, Senator. It's an attempt to prevent a wholesale request for email addresses that could lead to people receiving emails for purposes that are not related to the purpose of them giving the address to the agency in the first place. I would also note, although it's not germane particularly to your question, that the second part of the subsection specifically excludes from the provision the addresses assigned by the public body to public employees for the use of the employee in the ordinary course of employment. So it's not intended to hide the public addresses of public employees.
Okay. Yes, Senator.
I want to thank you for bringing this bill because I've been very concerned that people, we like to communicate with my constituents by newsletter. And I've been very concerned that people with other interests have been getting those, filing requests for those email addresses to use for their own purposes, and I feel that's not what my constituents signed up for. And I just want to thank you for bringing this, because I think it's important in terms of our relationship with our constituents that they know that when they sign up with us, they're not going to get spammed by, as you call it, every soap company in town.
Thank you, Senator Burdick, for your comment. And I don't see any further questions for you, Representative Barnhart. So thank you very much bringing this to us and for your testimony. We have no one else signed up to testify on this bill. And so we are in a work session. Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3294A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 3294A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, just a clarifying question, and I'm not sure it can be answered, but in the SMS, it says that House Bill 3294A would exempt from public disclosure a personal email address provided to a state agency, commission, board, or local government or local service district or special government by a public employee. The way I heard the bill described, the protection would be for a private citizen, not the public employee. So, Madam Chair, I'm not sure whether the SMS is wrong or whether the intent of the bill is just to protect public employees from the disclosure, not private citizens.
So perhaps our committee administrator might want to address this. I could hazard a guess, but...
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Farioli. You're speaking to the background portion there.
I think it's the last paragraph under the background that Senator Farioli was reading. And Senator Farioli, are you, you're questioning whether private citizens who are not public employees would be or should be in some way protected, because I think the intent of this bill has been to prevent disclosure of private email addresses for employees of these governmental entities, and those email addresses are not used in the course of their employment. So I'm not sure how somebody who's a private citizen but doesn't work for any governmental entity would ever come under this bill.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you receive several hundred emails a day, and so do I, from private citizens. And those are private emails and public records. So the question about disclosure has to do with whether or not the agency is being asked to disclose the inbox or the email address from the private citizen, or whether we're being asked to protect just the private email addresses of the bureaucrats receiving the emails.
Lori.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I think it may be inartfully worded, but it references the personal emails provided by the public employee to any of those entities listed.
So, Madam Chair, then this bill does nothing to protect the private email of private citizens, only the private email of public employees. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. And is there further?
I'm sorry, okay. Madam Chair, I was just referencing that particular background paragraph to Senator Farioli.
I'm not
speaking to the measure. I was just answering his question about that background paragraph.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think that's clear.
It's my understanding, Madam Chair, that this also covers the private citizen who contacts a public agency or one of our offices. We have somebody here, I'll bet, could talk about that. Okay. All right, thanks.
Did you want to speak to that?
Sure, if you want to address that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Phil Barnhart. You have to go to the language on page 7 of the bill in order to get the answer to the question that you're talking about. I think that the last line of the SMS that you're referring to is very inartfully drafted. It does. I'm not sure why it got drafted that way. The bill itself says electronic mail addresses in the possession or custody of an agency and so forth and so on. It doesn't say email addresses of public employees. It says electronic email addresses. And then it exempts from that provision the email addresses that are actually issued by the public body for use by public employees in the ordinary course of their employment. So the idea being, of course, that the Rep.Phil Barnhart email address is public information no matter what. It's the email addresses that we receive or that these agencies receive in the ordinary course of their business that would not be subject to disclosure except at the agency's discretion, as I described in the material from Dexter Johnson.
So thank you for that clarification. I think we're going down a pretty slippery slope here, but we certainly could get legislative counsel in the room, Senator Farioli, if we need to talk about a records retention policy, although this bill only applies to email addresses in possession of the agencies of the executive department of the state or these other governmental entities. So if we need to talk to the drafter about exactly those statutes that this links to, we certainly could recess. We do have some witnesses who are going to have to leave shortly on other bills too.
Well,
so,
Madam Chair, I don't know that that's necessary. I can satisfy my curiosity between now and the floor session, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, that would be great too.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Barnhart. Further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. And I think we'll ask Senator Burdick if she would volunteer to carry this bill.
Yes, I will, Ms. Madam Chair, even though I'm not quite sure. I thought it applied to agencies beyond just our executive.
It does.
Okay.
It does.
Right. Then I would be happy to carry it.
Great. Okay, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3294. Hi. So I know that we have some senators in the room. I know that Raquel is here on House Bill 3294, but I also was handed a note that we have a witness who has to leave in 5 minutes on another bill. So I think that to accommodate somebody who's not usually in the building, we will open a public hearing for the purposes of, and if that's okay with the senator, and you can bear with us for a moment, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 414A. Lori, could you briefly tell us what this bill is?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 414A allows the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to seek restitution and other equitable relief on behalf of consumer for actual damages consumer suffers as a result of insurer's violation of insurance code, breach of contract or policy, or violation of applicable federal law. It clarifies the action by the director is not a right of action for any other person. It declares emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay. Thank you, Lori. And we do only have two people signed up to testify on this bill, so I'll call them both, and they are Paul Trudell and Lou Savage. If you'd both like to come forward. Thank you for waiting so patiently.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Trudell, and I'm a resident of Northwest Portland in Senator Burdick's district, so good to be here, and thank you for accommodating my schedule. I'm a volunteer advocate working primarily with individuals with autism, but also other people who have been having concerns with processing insurance claims. And over the last 2 years, I have worked with nearly 100 families purely as a volunteer, helping them either fill out insurance claims or fill out appeals related to claims. And in many of those cases, we have been extremely successful. I have used the external review process, for instance, about two dozen times and have succeeded in almost every instance, resulting in hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably close to $1 million in benefits paid to consumers, which has been great. What we ran into, though, you know, in there were obviously, you know, in appeals and the interactions with the insurance companies, there are obviously cases where, you know, you don't agree with the insurance company. And in many of those, we have worked through the consumer complaints process with the insurance division. And as, you know, we got into that as novices, you know, consumers, we found that there were some cases where, you know, we would file a complaint, the insurance company would agree and say, you know what, you're right, we made a mistake, we'll take care of it. And those obviously got resolved very quickly. And then we found other cases where, you know, we'd kind of hear feedback from the insurance division that they thought that we were right, that maybe the contract terms had been violated or the insurance company wasn't following the law correctly, but we weren't really getting anything done. You know, we'd sort of hear feedback saying, yeah, we think you're onto something, but we didn't really get anything. And at first we were frustrated, and we had an initial draft that was basically aimed at, you know, transparency in the consumer complaints process. But the more we got into it and talked with people in the insurance division and listen to some public testimony, we realized that there's actually a fundamental issue, and that is that the insurance division doesn't appear to have the authority currently to actually require restitution to a consumer. As we understand it, the insurance division can, you know, issue a civil penalty, it could revoke an insurer's license to practice, it can reach an agreement with an insurance company, but actually requiring restitution, you know, compelling something, doesn't appear to be an authority that it had. And so we put in Senate Bill 414 to basically help the insurance division and help us as consumers resolve these things. And what, you know, I was very happy to see in some of the testimony on House Bill 3160, which I will give a quick plug for. I think it's a great bill, and I would love to see it go forward. That's the unfair trade practices bill. But many of the insurance companies who you know, complained about that bill were actually putting forward Senate Bill 414 as an alternative they liked. Yeah, I think we've just passed out some notes from the Standard and State Farm and so forth, you know, regarding that. And so we think it is something that we would really encourage you, you know, to take action on and move on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Oregon Insurance Commissioner. This is not our bill, as Mr. Turdall pointed out, but it certainly would be an additional tool in our toolbox to help consumers. As Mr. Turdall pointed out, we do have authority, fairly robust authority, under an anti-fraud provision in the insurance code, as well as the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. What we don't have is the authority to order restitution, which is, in our view, one of the most important things we could do, which is to actually put the dollars back into consumers' pockets quickly, without the need for a consumer to go to court to do that. The insurer or a producer would certainly have the right to ask for an administrative hearing, so there would be due process, but that process is certainly a lot quicker and a lot more expedient than court, which I think was a frustration that Mr. Turdall certainly expressed to us in the past. So although we have the authority to issue civil penalties, we actually don't have the authority right now to put dollars back into consumers' pockets.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Farioli and then Senator Beyer.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm going to assume that there's no cost to consumers for this service. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, absolutely not.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, if I may continue.
Yeah, follow up.
So is it complaint-driven? Does the consumer have to contact DCBS, or can DCBS initiate a complaint without the permission of the consumer?
No, in the case of restitution, I can't imagine a situation where we would do it on our own, because we actually wouldn't know who the consumer was who would have been harmed.
And Madam Chair, does the consumer have the right to litigate further if they're not satisfied with the remedy that the DCBS negotiates or settles for or compels? In other words, is there an estoppel against the consumer if you go out and take the agency action and compel a solution, but the consumer is not satisfied with it?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, with respect to the restitution order itself, we would certainly get the permission of the consumer to to issue that order and enter into any kind of a settlement. I would say that there may be circumstances where there may be damages above and beyond the restitution that we order, but my experience in court, I'm a former litigator, is that a court would look at whatever damages we ordered and recovered on behalf of the consumer to be offset against any other claim that a consumer may have.
Madam Chair, that is the crux of the question. Wouldn't the court regard the settlement as liquidated damages?
Well, I'm not going to give you legal advice, but that would be certainly the actual damages, not liquidated damages, because that's really more of a contract theory. But the actual, whatever actual damages that were recovered as a result of the order of restitution would certainly be offset.
Madam Chair, I see that the consumer would not have any recourse against the agency.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, no more or no less than they have now.
Well, there's no, there would be no private right to action to any other individual. I just assumed that meant the agency as well.
And Senator Ferrioli, I apologize for interrupting the witness, but I'm just, you know, always as a last resort, read the actual language of the bill. And I'm looking on page 2 of the bill, lines 1 through 3, which say an action or proceeding that the director institutes under subsection 1 of this section is an exercise of the director's regulatory authority and except as otherwise provided in section 3 does not create a cause of action for any other person. So it does sound like that may not fully address what Senator Ferrioli was asking you, but it sounds like this is not creating litigation that wouldn't exist notwithstanding the language of the bill. So,
Madam Chair, that's how I read the language.
So I guess I'm going to assume, Madam Chair, that means that the consumer unsatisfied with the solution can sue the agency.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think the question would be other person, whether that would include the agency itself.
That is the question, Madam Chair. We agree on the question, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any more questions, so thank you both for your testimony. And we don't have anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 414?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer here representing the Independent Agents of Oregon and the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisor. And I didn't sign up to testify, but there was a phrase that the commissioner just used that gave me some pause or concern, so I'd like to have him come up and clarify. But he said insurers or producers, action against insurers or producers, and I don't find producers anywhere in this bill. And so I just wanted to make sure or to have him clarify possibly where he would find the authority in this bill to take action against a producer. And in Oregon law, producers are agents. So with that, I'll put on the record, if he'd be so good as to come back up and point to where that authority would be, I'd be very thrilled. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome back.
Chair Rosenbaum, I sit corrected. It is this bill deals directly with insurers.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Great. Glad we could clear that up.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
To former Senator Beyer, I say we miss your attention to detail in the process.
Okay. I think we're only in a public hearing right now. But we don't have anybody else signed up to testify, and we probably could move through this pretty quickly. So I'll close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 414A. And Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 414A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 414A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Senator Ferrioli? Okay. And Mike, would you please call the roll on the motion?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Excused.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries. And I see that Senator Shields is the chief sponsor of this bill, so we'll ask him to carry it. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 414A. And
this bill was
open public hearing on House Bill 2233A. And thank you for joining us, Raquel. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. And would you like to tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 2233A defines abandoned and derelict vessel. It defines enforcement agency. It establishes a process and authority for the enforcement agency to seize abandoned or derelict vessels. It allows the vessel owner to request and receive a hearing, and it authorizes seizure without notice if the vessel poses a hazard to navigation, public health, and safety. It also holds owners liable for costs incurred by the enforcement agency and reduces the owner's liability by net proceeds if the enforcement agency sells the vessel. It allows the owner to reclaim the vessel upon payment of all costs, and it exempts the enforcement agency from liability for damage resulting from seizure. It also creates an offense of failure to remove the abandoned vessel and an offense of possession of derelict vessel, and it replaces the abandoned boat removal and cleanup subaccount with a salvaged vessel subaccount and establishes authorized uses. It also adds a ship in danger of sinking to the definition of threatened spill or release in the spill response and hazardous materials statutes, and allows the Director of Department of Environmental Quality to enter upon a ship to address spill or release of oil or hazard material. We do have a proposed A6 amendment as well as a proposed A7 amendment. The difference between the two is that Section 10 of the amendment and Section 10 of the bill is removed, which is in regards to the enforcement agency's liability. And I'm sure we'll hear some testimony about the reasons behind that. If you'd like, I can also tell you what the A6 and A7 amendment have in common.
So we do have Senator Roblin, the chair of the committee from whence this bill came here, so perhaps we should let him come forward before we get into further detail. And thank you, Senator Roblin. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, and thank you so much for waiting so patiently. We have had a hectic day.
It's always fun to watch other committees in action. And for the record, Senator Arne Roblin, House District, Senate District 7, 5. I'll get it all right here. Senate District 5, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay. This bill came to us from the House with pretty overwhelming support and came to the my committee. And a couple of my committee members were very concerned with the broad scope that it allowed for the definition of derelict vessels and so on. And I asked if they would be willing to work to tighten that up. And they said they would. That was 6 weeks ago. They have worked diligently during that time. And I commend them for that. We felt we had a pretty good bill yesterday and came to some issues, and you'll hear later from the Sheriff's Association, those people who are responsible for removing them, that they were concerned about one section. That's why we have the difference between the sixes and the sevens. And the sevens took out a section that they were felt added more liability to them. We did not think of that at the same time, but I've talked to Senator Bertschinger. He agrees. He actually offered that up at one time during the negotiations that took place. This is a really important bill in the sense that we do have a number of derelict vessels around our state, and one of the areas that I have worked on in past sessions has to do with the Columbia River interface with Washington. We had differing expectations with respect to ballast water on the Columbia River, and it led to the opportunity for people to drift across the river to let go of their ballast water in Oregon waters because Washington had a different standard. We have since cleaned that up over the last number of years. This is a bill that does the same thing. If it's easier to get rid of a boat or a vessel you don't want and you move it across the river and drop it on our shores, it's not something we want to do. So it is a coordinated effort with Washington, Oregon, along the Columbia. But these are issues that our sheriffs have to deal with on all of our water bodies, including the coast. When you have a vessel that is, there is no response, you can't get a hold of the owner, they don't want to have it. Things like the serial numbers and other things have been scraped off so you can't figure out whose it was in the first place. And we do have a fund that allows us to do it, but it takes many months to remove that vessel. This bill tightens that up a little bit, and one of the concerns that the good Senator Bertscher and the good Senator Close had was that we don't want someone to lose their regular property because of actions that were taken too hastily. And so what we have done is we've narrowed in the Dash 7s the definition of what a derelict vessel is and its owner so that everybody has a clear idea what those are and what causes a vessel to become derelict. We've strengthened the due process requirements, including extending the pre-seizure notice and post-seizure time to request a hearing, requiring probable cause to believe vessel abandoned or derelict, allowing an owner to present a plan to remediate the problem prior to seizure, and narrowing the authorization for the enforcement agency to enter and inspect vessels. I think that the A7s will ensure that owners of vessels are treated fairly while allowing us to improve the safety of our rivers by removing abandoned vessels and making sure that those vessels that get dislodged in our threatening bridges or threatening to spill into our waterways can be dealt with in a much more expedited way, making sure that we keep these waters the best we can for our state. And I appreciate what the Marine Board and DEQ have done to work closely with our administrator and our senators to get this bill to you as it is today. And I'd be glad to ask any questions.
Thank you. Senator Roblin, I know having checked in with you regularly since this bill was referred to our committee that you and Senator Bertscher have been working very, very hard to try to address a real problem, but also address concerns that have arisen, and even as recently as
this morning,
or perhaps a couple of hours ago, you were still working on that. And I know that Senator Bertscher would have been here, but had
he came
meeting.
For a while. We talked and made sure, and he got a copy to make sure that we've done all the things that he felt were very important. And so I appreciate his diligence and his working to get this done.
That's great. And we do have the Marine Board and several other people signed up to testify, as well as Legislative Council, who I know have been working really hard with other attorneys to make sure this bill is perfect. So.
That's right. Well, we hope for a good bill. Perfection we'll work on later.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farrelly.
I have a question for the proponent, the chief proponent.
Yes.
I think, Madam Chair, I heard testimony that this bill came from the House with the overwhelming support, and yet it only took 6 weeks to repair it.
That's perfectly said.
I see.
Perfectly said.
And Madam Chair, perhaps we should, instead of listening to the testimony, perhaps we should move the bill before we're required to make further improvements.
Thank you, Senator.
I have no problem
with that.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Roblin.
Yep.
Okay. We do have several people who've come
to
tell us briefly.
Oh, good.
Right. And I will point out to committee members that, and I think Raquel alluded to this, there is an A7 which essentially replaces the A6 amendment.
Is that the warm amendment?
It's the one hot off the presses that I think Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council can tell us about if we need him to. But it essentially deletes one section of the bill dealing with some liability provisions that was in response to a concern that can be addressed by Daryl Fuller, who's here on behalf of the sheriff. So I'll call Scott Bruin and Rachel Boleen.
Yeah.
And I think you have. Good afternoon, and thank you. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. Thank you for waiting patiently. And I think you've got a sense that people may be pretty enthusiastic about this bill already, and we're certainly eager to hear why it's needed, but we don't probably need to hear everything about it. So,
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. I'm happy to provide a quick overview for you. I know I've met with committee members, and we have worked diligently through this bill to deal with the concerns that were brought up. Rachel does have a slideshow, which picture speaks a thousand words, that she can go through pretty quickly and show you some of the things that we're dealing with. But what I will say is the Marine Board has a fund that we put in state voter dollars, $150,000 per biennium, to deal with abandoned vessels. We rarely spend the money that is available in that fund. The reason isn't that there aren't abandoned vessels to deal with. The issue is that there's a lot of problems with the statute in accessing that funding in order to deal with those vessels. So what this bill is intended to do is to make that money more accessible and to make the process work better, both for the enforcement agencies and for it also adds a lot of due process for an owner of a vessel in case something was done inappropriately. They have due process to deal with that. So in the process of working through the A6 amendment, we did deal with a lot of concerns that were brought up regarding the authority of the enforcement agencies and ensuring that enforcement agencies understand and act appropriately when dealing with derelict vessels. And by that I mean concerns that not all enforcement agencies may understand what a derelict vessel looks like, that they need to make sure that they have probable cause to make sure that they deal with these vessels as well as the abandoned vessels. So we tighten some of those issues up as well. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I did provide written testimony that talks about the A6 amendment. There's also an attachment to it that goes through kind of piece by piece through the bill and explains why we did what we did up to the A6 amendment. The last thing I'll say is the A7 amendment was brought about because of concerns brought up by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association with regard to liability protection. When we originally put this bill forward, it had liability protection up to gross negligence. That was a concern for the committee. So rather than take that language out, we looked at something that was higher than negligence but didn't go to that level of gross negligence. We thought we had some pretty good wording for that, but there were some concerns that were brought forward. So we are supportive of the A7 amendment, which gets rid of the Section 10 out of the bill, which would essentially keep the liability protection as it currently stands under current law. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Rachel to quickly run you through some examples of the vessels that we're dealing with.
Great.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Rachel Bleen, Policy Analyst for the Oregon State Marine Board. And I just have a really brief slideshow to illustrate some of the problems of abandoned and derelict vessels and talk about how House Bill 2233 provides some solutions. So first of all, I just want to emphasize this is a statewide problem. These two vessels were just removed last month from the Willamette River, cost about $7,000, but they were first noticed in August of last year when they were taking on water, but it took us until last month to get them out of the water and removed. We have vessels like former fishing vessels, the Captain Nielsen. The City of Warrenton Marina has been dealing with this vessel for well over a year. This abandoned houseboat in Klamath Lake actually was just removed last Friday, cost about $7,000, but it was first noticed, again, I think December of last year, and it was abandoned at a public fishing pier. So you can see this was actually a public nuisance for months, blocking fishing access at a public facility. Boats like this one that were found on the Columbia River, this was deliberately dumped. The HIN number was removed, all registration numbers removed, and it was stripped of all metal. So this is something that happens frequently where people are dumping their vessels instead of taking responsibility and disposing them properly. And then our ports have problems with vessels that are abandoned when people just stop paying their mortgage dues and walk away. Phone numbers disconnected, mails returned, so then the port is stuck with vessels like the Cloud 9, which we helped them remove about 2 months ago. And since I put this slideshow together, we're dealing now with three abandoned vessels in Lane County, a vessel in Yamhill County, Columbia County, Washington County, and Multnomah County. So all of those on the books right now. Just want to talk about derelict vessels and why we wanted the definition of derelict vessel in the bill. We know that most derelict vessels, that are vessels that are in a hazardous condition, will eventually become abandoned. This vessel we call OR-15MU, that's its registration number, was tracked for over a year by Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, spotted at different times, anchored illegally on state-owned lands. It sunk at least twice. The picture there, that was sunk at a public dock in Portland. And the picture at the bottom there, finally, it is abandoned now. It's been stripped of all metal, of anything valuable, been left in Swan Island Lagoon, City of Portland. So if we could have intervened earlier, perhaps when the vessel first sunk, we could have avoided having this vessel out there for over a year. And it's currently still in Swan Island Lagoon. We also know that it's more cost-effective to deal with vessels when they're still floating than waiting until they sink. This is an example of a vessel abandoned on the Port of Portland property. Our first quote, when it was floating there, $500, but because our process to remove the vessel is quite long, it's filled with rainwater, capsized, sunk, so it eventually cost us $1,500 to remove. So you can see we could have removed, you know, three vessels for that cost. Derelict vessels are a navigation hazard as well. This vessel was anchored out on public lands. This is the Willamette River, and left unattended for weeks. This photo is from December 1st of last year. By December 3rd, the vessel had filled with rainwater to the point where it did sink. At that time, Portland Fire responded and the Coast Guard, and they tried to move the vessel out of the navigation channel. But before they could remove it from the water, they looked for the owner. In that time, the boat broke loose, drifted 5 miles down the river under 8 bridges in Portland. So you can see that is a hazard to our infrastructure and could have been a hazard to other vessels on the river. This is what the vessel looked like when we pulled it out December 10th. And the cost of removing this vessel, well over $5,000. This is another typical vessel adrift on the Columbia River in Columbia County. This is what it looks like up close. You can see vessel, not much value. The story here is that because our current statutes say we have to store the vessel for up to 90 days, that's an incredible cost for something that's not worth very much money. This boat costs about $380 to put on a flatbed trailer and tow it to an impound lot, but $300 a month to store that while we went through the process to notify the previous owner. And the vessel hadn't been registered since 1993, so we had no luck in finding a responsible party. And this is my final vessel, the former Vancouver Yacht Club. It was a floating home, 65-by-65-foot floating structure. It was actually the clubhouse for the Vancouver Yacht Club over in Washougal, Washington. It was sold to a gentleman for $10 and illegally moored in Washington for years before it broke loose in March of 2012. Drifting down the river, was spotted right before it was approaching the I-5 bridge. Commercial tug spotted it, called the Coast Guard. Coast Guard said, tie it up at the closest facility that you can secure the vessel. And that happened to be the Metro's Gleason Memorial Boat Ramp. And this is a brand new facility, multi-million dollar public facility. The problem is that the current statutes say only law enforcement and ports have the authority to remove vessels. So Metro did not have the authority to deal with this vessel, even though it was abandoned at their facility. And unfortunately, it took us several months to work out a plan how to get rid of this vessel. It took 5 months for that floating home to be removed from their dock and taken to a dismantling facility. So that's 5 months when the public couldn't use this public facility, 5 months of stress on that expensive new dock. And this vessel was extremely expensive to get rid of, cost Metro and the Marine Board over $87,000. So that's it. Just showing the timeline. House Bill 2233 does shorten up the timeline in terms of the amount of time we have to hold the vessel. So this protects the environment and saves money. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Thanks for all your work. Any questions? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
We have two more people signed up, and I'll just call them together. And if you could come forward, that's Daryl Fuller and Joe Rolliter. And members, while they're getting settled, and Senator Starr, you weren't in the room when we started out on this bill, but we heard from Senator Roblin on behalf of himself and Senator Bert Sugar, who have both been working to perfect this bill since it moved over from the House. We have an A7 amendment. We have Dave Hendricks, who drafted it. We don't actually have the paperwork to be able to move the bill completely today, although we can suspend the rules in order to adopt this amendment, and I think that's what Mr. Fuller is going to be talking about. So whichever of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. First, I want to let you know that on OLIS you have my testimony on the -A6 amendments. We prefer the -7 amendments because of our concerns with the -A6 amendments, but actually the only problem that we really have with the -A6 turns out to be Section 10 of the bill, which the -A7s take care of. Yesterday afternoon, I got the -A6 amendments for the first time. I sent them out to some folks whose opinions are important to the sheriffs. I woke up this morning to 23 pages of emails with a number of concerns from various attorneys. I'm sort of reminded of the cliche that you can take all of the lawyers in the world and stack them end to end and still not reach a conclusion, which is, I think, where we're at with what the Section 10 of the A6 amendments would do. The attorneys representing the sheriff said they would be less helpful, while the people that wrote the amendments were intending them to be more helpful, which is why we want to go back to the original language, which is what the -A7s do. And I don't want to belabor any more of the conversations other than I'm willing to answer any questions you have, and to say that the next time that Paul Allen's yacht, the Octopus, is in the Columbia River, I think Multnomah County is planning to seize it as a derelict vessel just for the fun of it. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I represent Seafood Oregon, which is the four commodity commissions created by the state for us fishermen that work on the ocean. It's the Salmon Commission, the Albacore Commission, the Dungeness Crab Commission, and the Trawl Pink Shrimp Commission. We support the -7 amendments. We think this is a good bill. We believe that the safeguards for our boats being seized when they really aren't derelict is great in this bill, so as amended. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. I also want to thank Dave Hendricks, who I know has been working tirelessly on this bill, and not only on this bill, but particularly I'm aware that you've worked very hard, and so the previous comments and lawyer jokes notwithstanding, some of us do appreciate that we're taking great care when we're drafting these bills, even in the waning days of session, to get them right. So thank you for that. So members, did we have any desire to hear from Legislative Council? Doesn't look like it. It looks like we are fine. So thank you again. And so members, that completes our sign-up sheet. And so that is our public hearing. Is there anyone else who needs to testify on this bill today? Doesn't look like it. So I'll close the public hearing. And members, we cannot move the bill out, although we can adopt the -A7 amendments. And I think that would allow what's already happening, which is the people, the good folks in LFO, to complete their work. And then when we come back next week, we'd be able to actually move the bill to the floor, or we can wait and adopt the amendment next week. So either would work.
Madam Chair, yes. Are we in work session?
I'll open, and is that okay with everybody? Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2233A, Senator Byer. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that in the motion? No.
No,
we don't. We actually don't have that scripted for you. So what we need to do, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, I would move that to suspend the rules for the purpose of adopting the -7 amendments to House Bill 2233A.
That is exactly perfect. So Senator Byer has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of adopting the -A7 amendment to House Bill 2233. Is there discussion on the motion to suspend the rules? Is there objection? Okay, rules are suspended. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I would move the adoption of the Dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2233A.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has moved the Dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2233A. Is there a discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chair, the purpose of the amendment is to restore the previous liability section 10, is that correct?
Perhaps we should ask Dave Hendricks to come forward. The Dash A7s do contain all the provisions of the Dash A6s except for one, and I think Dave will talk about that.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council's office. Senator Ferrioli, all that the Dash 7s do is, the original draft of the bill would have eliminated any liability for towing vessels. That moved on to another set of amendments that said, well, the law enforcement agency that towed it would only be liable if they were grossly negligent. The next proposal was to get rid of that entirely and just go back to the standard, you're liable if you're liable underneath the normal law. The reason that Section 10, as it now appears in the bill, went in was there was actually a thought that there was some concern about giving some additional protection in scenarios where it just simply wasn't clear who caused the damage, because under the law there's situations where you go and say, well, you know, you had the boat, it got damaged, you should have to pay. The way the bill now stands, we're just underneath the normal rules of negligence, same rules that would apply to any other law enforcement agency, for instance, seizing a vehicle, what have you, to basically be able to say, same rules apply. It just eliminates any special rule with respect to towing vessels.
That isn't clear.
It's perfect.
I think clearly
another improvement to the bill.
Right. And if you had a chance to look at the sheriff's written testimony, that was a concern that they raised, and I think this amendment came about in order to address it. So,
yeah. So I think there was concern it actually would increase their liability. That wasn't the intent, but the decision, I think, was just simply better not to just to leave it alone, leave liability the way it is, so the bill now doesn't change liability at all with respect to these scenarios.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Is there objection to this amendment? Okay, hearing none, the amendment is adopted. And that is as far as we can get with this today. So I will close the work session on House Bill 2233A. Members with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.
I'm betting you there's